Welcome to session number 352 of the 2000 Sunstone Symposium, Evil Among Us, the Texas Mormon Missionary Murders. I have to remind you, I have a little note here, if you haven't done your survey, symposium surveys that are out in front of doors or probably at the table, if you could fill one of those out, that would help us respond to how you feel about this. And let's start. I'm very interested in this topic for a couple of reasons. I was able to read the shorter article that Ken Driggs wrote in Sunstone. What issue is that?
December 1997.
Yeah, he'll mention that. I found it especially interesting as I had, as a young greeny missionary in Texas in 1986, was terrified by the story they told me as I opened my mission in an area that was covered, this area of, that he will speak about, where this took place, north of Austin in Texas. So that was about 12 years after the murders had taken place in 86, and it was the first story that missionaries were told by ward members, so it was always a bit of an interesting way to start out, I think, for missionaries. I know the facts were very probably twisted and exaggerated from what we'll be hearing about today, but it was a very interesting story about what took place in that area. And as I served there, and actually they opened the area to missionaries for the first time very soon after that. So quite a few years had gone by that the missionaries served in that exact area. We were in a town right next to it. So Ken Driggs is a career criminal defense lawyer who for the last 10 years has defended death penalty cases in Florida, Texas, and now Georgia. It was during a three-year period of defending cases in Austin, Texas, that he came across the missionary murders and decided to write about it. Driggs holds a journalism degree from the University of Florida, a Mercer Law degree, and a Master of Laws degree from the University of Wisconsin. He has published extensively on Mormon topics, and he is a sixth-generation Mormon and a member of the Atlanta Ward of the Church. He's going to share his paper, and then we don't have an official response, so we will take questions from the audience. We'll leave some time for that at the end. So go ahead, Mr. Driggs.
I've spoken about this a couple of times before, and it usually generates a lot of questions, so I want to make a point to leave time for that. This is the issue of Sunstone that an article ran in, and the article actually plays into the story later on. It triggered some other events that I'll tell you about, but I hope they will have some of these in the sales room where they have some back issues of Sunstone. It's December 1997, and it's the one that has the cartoon on the cover of the baptism of the 10 millionth Mormon. I thought it might be of interest for me to start by telling you a little bit about my interest in this case. I was living in Austin. I remember dimly hearing about this case in my home ward in Tallahassee, Florida, as a young man. And I was living in Austin at the time, doing death penalty defense work there in, I started working on this in January 1995. And I've always been interested in Mormon history, so I was interested in that level. My graduate degree is in legal history, so I'm interested in the development of law. And one reason why this was particularly interesting to me is that the man who was prosecuted for the murder of these Mormons was the second or third person prosecuted under Texas's new death penalty statute after the death penalty was restored. The Supreme Court struck down all the death penalty statutes in the United States in 1972, and in 1976 they affirmed the new statutes that were passed in as a result of that, and this case took place kind of in the interim. So it was both prosecuted and defended by lawyers that were learning. Yes? All right, I'm sorry. Let me start over a little bit then. I have a graduate degree in legal history, and I'm particularly interested in the development of death penalty law. In 1972, the Supreme Court struck down the death penalty statutes of every state in the country, And then in 1976, they, in a series of cases, affirmed a series of new statutes that were passed in the interim. Well, this case and the prosecution of Bob Cleason for the murder of these missionaries came in that window. He was the second or third prosecution in Texas where a prosecutor sought a death sentence after the enactment of new laws and before the Supreme Court had passed on the laws. And so I was interested in how the lawyers, both on the defense and prosecution side, were sort of groping into how they handled these kinds of cases. So that was interesting to me. I mean, it was interesting to me on a number of levels. And when I started doing research with an eye towards maybe an article or two, I was surprised at how much information I found and realized this has got to be a book. So let me, with that segue, go into my formal paper. On June 9th, 2000, 67-year-old United States citizen Bob Cleason was sentenced to 3 years in a British prison by Crown Court Judge Michael Heath. The sentence followed Cleason's reluctant guilty plea to 4 counts of illegal possession of firearms and ammunition. In mitigation of his crime, Cleason claimed to have been a retired high-ranking CIA agent, a U-2 spy pilot, a holder of multiple PhDs, and to have been innocently misunderstood. The British media had been prevented from discussing the Cleason case until his guilty plea in mid-March 2000. Once his plea was entered, the story was trumpeted from the front pages of most major British newspapers under headlines like "The Secret of Death Row, From Death Row to Barton, Public Concerns That Anyone Can Come to England, and Who Gave Texas Chainsaw Massacre Man a Gun License." That's my personal favorite. His armed presence in England became the subject of a debate in the House of Commons amid promises of tightening England's already stringent gun control laws and new immigration controls. Judge Heath urged the British Home Office to deport Cleason back to the United States after he had served his sentence. Home Secretary Jack Straw had already announced his intention to do just that. Cleason appeared to be a pathetic, broken-down old fat man shuttling about in a wheelchair or on canes. Since coming to England in the fall of 1990 and marrying a British national in January 1991, he was seen by some as an American hero with a detailed knowledge of guns and airplanes. To others, he was an eccentric braggart. Odd Bob is what some of the locals called him. And to a growing number, he was a man with a quick temper prone to violence. The charges arose because Cleason had secured a series of permits to own firearms and finally to deal in them. As part of the permitting process, he represented that he had no prior criminal record and that he had never been in a mental hospital. These conditions are similar to those required by the 1968 Federal Gun Control Act in this country. British law enforcement apparently took him at his word and never checked any of his United States records. The reality was that Cleason had a substantial psychiatric history that included many incidences of violence, that he had been convicted and sentenced to death for the 1974 murder of 2 LDS missionaries in Texas, that he had earlier shot a man in upstate New York, that he had violently assaulted a young Mormon woman in Denmark, and that at 18 he shot up a Buffalo Hospital emergency room, and that he had been previously deported by at least 2 countries. When police finally did learn something of his true life, partly through an internet posting of an article published in Sunstone about him, a search of his home produced more than 44 firearms, some of them not covered by any of the licenses he had secured. He was also a Mormon convert, and for much of his life had been fixated on the LDS Church. So let me talk now a little bit about the murders. On Monday afternoon, October 28, 1974, 2 young men serving missions for the LDS Church left a group of their friends to have dinner with a troubled recent convert, Cleason, that they had been fellowshipping. They were never seen or heard from again. Gary Darley, 20, was the senior companion. He had entered the mission field from Simi Valley, California, and had served in the Texas San Antonio mission for about 9 months. Mark Fisher, 19, was a very faithful Milwaukee convert from a convert family and had been in the mission field only 5 weeks. Charlie had recently befriended the difficult man. Several missionaries had taken on Cleason as a project, hoping to reactivate him and bring him the personal testimony that thus far had eluded him. Recently, they had done so in spite of increasing concerns of local ward and stake leaders. Within a couple days, other missionaries and local church leaders missed the 2 young men. Within a week, their American Motors car was found abandoned and stripped in a parking lot of a South Austin apartment complex. It still had the "Happiness is a Family Home Evening" bumper strip on the back. Police investigators were initially slow to see this as anything more than high-spirited boys run off, but after the car was found and a Mormon FBI agent began pushing, enormous investigative efforts were expended. Bob Cleason was an immediate suspect. He denied seeing the missionaries and gave conflicting statements as to whether they had been expected as dinner guests. The more police investigated his history, however, the more Gleason looked like a potential killer. The FBI agent encouraged other agencies to get involved in the case. Gleason was a notorious game poacher in the Texas Hill Country just west of Austin. Alcohol, tobacco, and firearms agents learned Gleason had bought a series of firearms in the area and that he was a fugitive from a New York felony assault charge and that he used a number of aliases. Finally, they learned that 3 years earlier, ATF had raided his home in Buffalo, New York, and had seized large quantities of illegal explosives and firearms, including Thompson submachine guns. They learned that he had a history of psychiatric treatment. Gleason lived in a small camper trailer parked behind the rural Austin taxidermy studio in Oak Hill. He was allowed to stay there by owner Lem Rathbone in exchange for being a night watchman and light custodial work. He had keys and complete access to the taxidermy studio. Gleason was expected to burn all the trash, which he did every weekend. Police later learned that his camper had been stolen from a local consignment lot a year earlier, about the time Gleason moved it onto the property. 10 days after the missionaries were last seen, a teenaged employee of the taxidermy shop was walking in tall grass not far from Gleason's trailer. He found the distinctive plastic name tag of one of the missionaries, Elder M.J. Fisher, Texas San Antonio Mission Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, with what appeared to be a bullet hole in it. This was found at Gleason's personal shooting range, where he often showed off his firearm skills to guests. Aware of publicity about the two missing missionaries, the teenager called the office. A lot of officers immediately responded and searched the property with the permission of Rathbone, but they found little of value. Within hours of this find, law enforcement decided they had to move. ATF had confirmed Gleason's illegal purchase of at least two firearms by this point. Agents sought a search warrant from a federal magistrate for those weapons. Local police and Texas Rangers were invited on the search, which was clearly driven by the missing missionaries. ATF agents found what they wanted in Gleason's trailer, along with several items of the missionaries' personal property and a letter from Darley confirming the October 28th dinner engagement. About 10 p.m. that night, Tuesday, November 5th, 1974, Gleason was arrested on federal firearms charges as he left a Pentecostal church meeting in Burnett, Texas. More weapons were found in his car. Gleason seemed stunned by the arrest. He would remain in custody until May 6, 1988. About 2 or 3 a.m., Gleason was being booked by Austin homicide detective Colin Jordan. Jordan suspected mental illness, and reaching for a possible alter ego named Richard Ratt, whose identity papers had been found in the trailer, asked if Ratt had any suggestions on where to look for the bodies of the two missionaries. Gleason's cryptic answer still mystifies Jordan. He said, "I'd look over the barrel and in the bush." For a couple of weeks, police conducted intensive searches of Gleason's trailer home, the taxidermy studio and grounds, and hundreds of miles of rural roads. As many as 1,000 Mormons joined in the highly organized searches, including LDS servicemen and helicopters from nearby Fort Hood. The bodies were never found. However, the blood-spattered watches of the missionaries were recovered from inside the camper trailer. Their missionary teaching materials, tires, and other items from their car were found in sheds around the trailer, and some of Gleason's clothing with human blood and hair on it were along with other incriminating documents. Most chilling of all, investigators seized from the taxidermy studio a bandsaw used to cut deer horns. Someone had badly misused the machine about the time of the disappearances, and the blade had to be replaced. The housing, plate, and other parts were covered with biological materials, which proved to be human blood, tissue, and head hair, positively identified as coming from Darley and Fisher. That was as close as they would ever come to finding the bodies. All hope was abandoned on November 13, 1974, when Gleason was charged with both murders. In the 9 months between the murders and his trial, Gleason's mental condition was repeatedly brought into question. He was examined by several mental health experts who agreed that he was mentally ill, most likely paranoid schizophrenia, but they were divided as to whether he was competent to stand trial. He fired every defense lawyer who even suggested he was not fully sane, and a Texas jury later ruled he was competent. Just before trial, Gleason granted an interview to the Associated Press in which he claimed a long and colorful history as an international spy and assassin. Gleason's erratic behavior made his conviction and death sentence almost a foregone conclusion. The prosecution rested after calling 45 witnesses, none of whom told the jury any details about Gleason's extended orbit around the LDS community. A handful of defense witnesses claimed to have seen or talked to the missionaries after October 28th. Gleason did not testify. The most damaging state testimony about the human substances found on the bandsaw and on Gleason's clothing went unchallenged by the defense. The jury returned a guilty verdict on June 2, 1975. Gleason took the stand for several hours at a day-long punishment phase, and he told a packed courtroom that he knew nothing of the missionary's fate. But on cross-examination, District Attorney Bob Smith pushed all of Gleason's schizophrenic buttons. His rambling testimony was filled with boasting about his fantasy life as a master spy and CIA assassin, as an international scholar who held multiple PhDs from European universities and spoke several languages, and about an international conspiracy to keep him from telling all he knew about government misconduct. The performance undoubtedly frightened the jury, who took just 21 minutes to return a verdict, which mandated a death sentence. Gleason's execution never occurred, however. In 1975, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals reversed the conviction, saying the search of the trailer was illegal. The evidence seized from the trailer consisted of the missionaries' watches with blood on them, some of their missionary materials, and a letter from Dolly to Gleason confirming their dinner engagement. The bandsaw, the name tag with a bullet hole in it, the tires and other parts taken from the car, and Gleason's clothing with the victim's hair and human blood on it was not affected by the search warrant aspects of the decision. The court left the door open for a second prosecution without the illegally seized evidence. After the trial, Ronnie Earle had replaced Robert O. Smith as the Travis County District Attorney. Earle made the decision not to re-prosecute after a fierce internal debate among his assistants and law enforcement officers, and also, by the way, some local Mormons who were involved in helping the prosecution or the law enforcement develop this case were involved in that decision, or were party to the discussion. They were not happy with the decision. But Gleason was convicted on federal firearms charges immediately afterwards, receiving a 9-year prison sentence, then on the old New York assault charge, receiving an additional consecutive 7-year sentence, or up to 7 years. He remained in prison until a controversial parole in May 1988 to Buffalo, New York. On September 8, 1990, he was released from supervision, a burned-out 325-pound man in very poor health, just 2 weeks shy of his 58th birthday. He quickly left for England and a woman he had corresponded with there. With that, I'd like to tell you a little bit about what I learned about Gleason's life, both before and then eventually after this crime. Gleason's parents were Elmer and Lydia Gleason, who married in Buffalo, New York in 1913. Robert Elmer Gleason was born on September 20th, 1932, and he was an only child. Both his parents were 42 years old at that time. I found out little about Gleason's childhood. His parents were poor, as were many in the Depression. Both his parents were apparently gun enthusiasts, and there was a lot of firearms in the home. There were strong indications that the father beat both mother and son. His father was institutionalized when Gleason was an adult, which suggests a genetic component to the mental illness. A psychiatrist who later evaluated Gleason reported stories about Gleason entertaining himself as a boy by going up to the attic of their Victoria Avenue home with a BB gun, where he would plunk away unobserved at other children up and down the street. On Christmas Eve Sunday in 1950, when Gleason was 18, he went berserk in a hospital while awaiting treatment for a foot injury. He stormed the emergency room brandishing a shotgun, cornered a nurse, fired the shotgun into the walls and ceiling around her 5 times, and then was finally wrestled to the floor by staff. After the incident, police raided his home and seized a number of firearms, swords, and knives. Gleason was first locked in a local psychiatric ward, then committed to Gowanda State Hospital, which incidentally was the same hospital his father was later committed to. He remained there as a resident or as an outpatient for the next 2 years. He was diagnosed as psychotic with a psychopathic personality. Hospital staff recorded that Gleason had a mental disease of long standing and that the prognosis for full recovery was poor. In the 1950s and early 1960s, Gleason worked at a series of low-skilled jobs in New York, Arkansas, and Texas. He came to love Texas, especially the many hunting opportunities he found in the hill country outside of Texas, outside of Austin. While in Texas in 1957, he also graduated from a mail-order taxidermy school, and he developed a close friendship with an Austin taxidermist named Lem Rathbone. In 1962, Gleason began work as an Erie County deputy sheriff. I think that's just amazing. It's the only job he ever had was as a deputy sheriff in the county where he shot up the hospital. The department likely did no background check, or they would have discovered the 1950 emergency room shooting incident. He was a jail guard, a position that did not normally expose him to the public, but the sheriff's department still received a steady stream of public complaints about his violent behavior. In 1964, he resigned rather than be fired. Gleason was married at least four times to foreign nationals. He had a daughter by his first wife who was from Mexico. His second wife was from Ecuador and was a good friend of the first wife. His third wife was from Sweden. His fourth wife was an unsuspecting British pen pal, Marie Longley, who recently divorced him. All four indicated he was violent and terrorized them. Three also witnessed him beating his elderly mother. At one point, he broke her hip, hospitalized her pretty severely. Gleason enrolled at SUNY Buffalo, where he secured a degree in sociology, awarded on June 9, 1970. He enrolled in graduate school, even though he'd been an average student at best, and told associates he was studying pornography. He possessed a considerable collection of it, but ATF agents who raided his home in 1971 noted that there was no sign of study and only indications that he just liked the stuff. During the period of his marriages and college studies, he was often an outpatient for psychiatric care of severe depression. Much of the time, he was taking medication for his mental illness. This was not always successful at controlling his violent outbursts. In 1966, his mother acquired a 75-acre farm in Wayne County, New York, which Gleason often visited. Wayne County is where Palmyra is located, and I suspect that Gleason's obsessions with Joseph Smith and the LDS faith began there as well. About this time, he also began showing up in the Williamson and Buffalo Mormon congregations after being tracked out by Center City missionaries in Buffalo in spring 1971. Two of the guests at his July 1, 1971 wedding to the Swedish woman were missionaries. He also had shown off his substantial gun collection and gun works to these missionaries, telling him that he was a CIA operative. On June 12, 1971, while Gleason and his Swedish fiancée and another friend were in the Wayne County farm, Gleason got in an armed confrontation with two local men on a nearby road. He shot one of them in the foot, hospitalizing him for 10 days. Gleason was prosecuted for armed assault and spent several months in jail awaiting trial. While he was jailed, on September 30, 1971, his Buffalo home, and he always lived at his parents' residence, he never had a residence of his own at any point that I can tell other than this stolen trailer, the home was raided again by ATF. The dollar value of the weapons seized was hotly debated for years, but ATF records reflect over 150 firearms seized, a number of Thompson submachine guns, hand grenades, 42,000 rounds of ammunition, and explosives. The agents in charge announced to the press that the firearms seized were worth $300,000. That was in 1971. On June 12, 1972, police rescued his third wife, the Swedish lady, who is now a virtual prisoner in the Cleason's home. She had managed to write the Swedish embassy pleading for help. And I have to tell you this story. I'll break off from my text on this. This woman, Cleason tells her that he reads and speaks Swedish and, you know, half a dozen other languages. He does not. He only speaks English. She has basically been locked up as a prisoner in this home. And she somehow has gotten a letter out to the Swedish consulate basically saying, I'm a prisoner, please help me. Well, the Swedish consulate contacted the Buffalo police, and somehow Gleason apparently had an attorney at this point who was notified about this. And Gleason learned that this inquiry was going on and somebody was going to come to try to rescue his wife. So he forced her to write a letter back to the Swedish embassy that he dictated in Swedish. He's leaning over her shoulder and saying, now write this, and as he dictates it, and remember, I know how to read Swedish, so no funny stuff. So she starts writing out what he's done, and, you know, two or three lines in the letter, she's pretty sure he doesn't read Swedish. So the letter goes on about, oh, we're newlyweds, and we just had a fight, and I overreacted, and don't pay any attention to my earlier letter, and then there's the line that says, help me, I am being forced to write this, and then she writes a couple more things of his. And then, he's extremely dangerous, please come with lots of guns, and then a couple more lines. So she's put into this Swedish letter the warning, and it goes out, and the end result of that is that a tactical squad shows up at the house and bang the door down, take her into custody, and she's on a plane back to Sweden the next morning. And Cleason just furious about this. I have a copy of the letter, both in Swedish and then the English translation. She was obviously quick-witted at that moment. Anyway, before leaving the country, she briefed the police on his increasingly erratic and violent behavior. Cleason hired and fired several lawyers on the assault charge. And by the way, he's been in and out of bail on this. He's out on bail for a while, and then the bail gets revoked because of some misconduct, and he's back in, but at the time of this raid, he's out. Cleason hired and fired several lawyers on the assault charge. By March 1972, when it finally became evident that he was going to prison on the charge, he jumped bail and fled to Europe. It's at this point that Cleason's behavior really passes into the surreal. He presents himself to the Copenhagen, Denmark LDS ward as a baptized Mormon named John T. Williamson. Williamson was a cousin of Cleason's who died in 1951 and was a favorite alias of his. He carried a passport in that name. Local leaders in the Copenhagen ward were finally told by Salt Lake City that no such member of the church existed. About this time, on August 20th, 1972, Cleason violently beat a young woman he had attached himself to in Copenhagen, hospitalizing her. Danish authorities jailed him, determined his passport was a fake, and began to both prosecute and expel him from the country. He was also prosecuted for forgery for altering his passport and for two bicycle thefts. During the several months he was in a Copenhagen jail, he corresponded with an English-speaking LDS family who saved all of his letters. And the local mission president, Grant R. Ibsen, went to considerable lengths to assist the Danish law enforcement. Those letters are important, by the way, because there's a big file of them up in the LDS church archives. They saved all of them, and they found their way to the church headquarters where they're in the archives. By November 1972, Cleason was expelled from the country. Instead of going back to the United States, he somehow ends up in Lebanon, accompanying a Lebanese national who was in the Copenhagen jail with him. He had apparently convinced the man and his friends that he could secure guns for them. It didn't take the Lebanese long to determine Cleason was nuts, and they dumped him at the United States Embassy in Beirut on November 24, 1972. A State Department cable asked Washington for guidance on Cleason and described him as emotionally disturbed and uncooperative. Cleason was repatriated to the United States, to Washington, D.C., by the embassy, which purchased his ticket to get him back to the States, and he fairly quickly went to Western Canada, just long enough to be expelled from that country. By January 1973, he shows up penniless at the Austin Taxidermy Studio owned by Lem Rathbone. Rathbone let him sleep in an unused office in the taxidermy business. And on April 26, 1973, Cleason stole a used 22-foot camper trailer and set it up behind this taxidermy shop. The Mormon family in Copenhagen had continued to write this Mormon family in Copenhagen. And they finally wrote him and told him they didn't want to have anything more to do with him. They wrote him a two-page, two-sentence letter that's also up in the church archives, dated February 2nd, 1973, saying, "We're not supposed to have contact with apostates. Please don't ever contact us again." Cleason didn't handle this well and becomes obsessed with convincing them that he's a faithful, good guy Mormon in spite of all they had learned to the contrary. At this point, he begins to present himself to the Austin First Ward of the church asking to be baptized. At first, a pair of missionaries were assigned to teach him, but they found he had no real follow-through, and they gave up on him. He continued to show up at church on an irregular basis. Members recall him showing up in the clean white t-shirt and jeans all the time. And he finally began to be taught the lessons again by members of the High Priest Quorum in the Austin Ward. So finally, on September 20th, 1973, he was baptized by Bishop Bruce Smith. 3 days later, he was ordained a priest in the Aaronic priesthood. Then Cleason prevailed upon the new bishop to write a letter to this Danish family, informing him that he was in them, that he was now a member in good standing of the Austin First Ward. And the next day, Cleason wrote a follow-up letter himself, enclosing a photocopy of the certificate of ordination. Having concluded Cleason was every bit the thug that the Danish mission president said he was, the couple took these most recent letters, along with all the other letters they had saved from Cleason, to the mission president. President Ibsen then took this material, wrote the presiding bishop in Salt Lake City on October 27, 1973, to warn the church about Cleason. His letter says, in part, I know we're supposed to forgive people and that they are forgiven their transgressions when they are baptized. But I believe this is something that the church should be aware of. And I feel that you will know whether it should need to have some further follow-up. And then he writes in rather circumspect terms in the letter what the Danish Copenhagen congregation's experience with Gleason had been. On November 12, 1973, the presiding bishopric wrote the Austin First Ward Bishop, enclosing a copy of President Ibsen's letter, and urging them to determine if Gleason had fully confessed his conduct in Denmark. Of course, Gleason had said nothing whatsoever. Thus began a year-long deterioration in Gleason's already troubled relationship with Texas Mormons. On December 7, 1973, Gleason was arrested on another poaching offense. He sat in a series of rural, small county jails in Texas and churned out a steady stream of letters to church leaders demanding that they provide him with a lawyer and post his bail and, in general, do what he wanted. His bishop and home teachers visited him in jail, sometimes bringing him food because it complained that the jailers there fed him poorly. An attorney was finally appointed by the court, and the poaching charge was resolved by spring, but New York authorities demanded his extradition for trial on the assault charge. The Texas authorities refused to request under the apparent belief that Gleason was a persecuted gun enthusiast and not a dangerous assailant. By the way, that decision ruined more than a few political careers in Texas when this all sort of unfolded. Gleason would often insist that this refusal to extradite in Texas amounted to a full pardon on the New York charges by the Texas authorities. So by the summer of 1974, Gleason seemed to be getting out of his legal troubles, but his problems with the Mormon Church remained. His former bishop had been succeeded by a University of Texas transportation professor named Frank McCullough. Bishop McCullough had concluded that Gleason was a dishonest, unrepentant troublemaker who had divided the ward and initiated excommunication proceedings. But the missionaries wanted to be missionaries. They and a few young members of the ward took an interest in this unhappy man and tried to fellowship him. They were inexperienced in life, and they accepted his CIA stories, giving him the kind of attention that he craved. In one letter Gleason mailed to a missionary over 2 months before the murders, he wrote, and he's talking here about his conflicts with local church leaders, "If this stake president wants a hell of a fight, he's my man, no mandy-pandy. I do not want a pat on the head and a paw shake. I want blood. I want to go in and finish this mess one way or the other. Either some authority will get up on his two hind legs and vindicate me publicly, or they can excommunicate me. I want to go after my false accusers now and bring them to dishonor, disgrace, and if possible, excommunication. This is how I feel. I have no mercy. I have no pangs of pity. I want their heads. If it has not, and if the church does not want to set the matter straight, then I have no recourse than to continue to be inactive, or they can do what they like. Few thought of me when I begged for help, and now I listen to no one. I go for the kill." Gleason wrote Bishop McCullough several times demanding that the bishop meet with him alone at his rural trailer. The bishop found the letters threatening and refused such a meeting. A few days before October 28th, the bishop called Elder Darley and urged that he and his companion not meet further with Gleason. Elder Darley told the bishop that he and Elder Fisher had accepted the October 28th dinner invitation from Gleason, and he felt they should at least keep that commitment. On Wednesday, October 23rd, 1974, young Mormons Jack Paris and his wife and their home teachers had their home teachers over to the apartment for dinner and fellowship. Partway through the meal, Gleason showed up at the Paris's for some promised help with a chore. The home teachers were also assigned to Gleason. One had even visited Gleason in jail, bringing him food. Almost as soon as Gleason entered the door, he berated the home teachers with such violence that everyone feared a physical attack would follow. After the home teachers diplomatically excused themselves and Gleason stormed off in a huff, Paris and the home teachers talked in the darkened apartment parking lot about what they should do. They were well aware of Gleason's skills with firearms and his frequent boasts of having killed for the CIA. Gleason really scared them. They decided his threats were serious enough that they should move away from their residences and live with relatives until Gleason cooled off. That Wednesday night is the last account I found of anyone who saw Gleason before the murders on the following Monday night. There's no question that this whole matter was a horrible tragedy. However, in reconstructing the story, I found something very positive in both the Fisher and the Darley families. These are very decent people who endured enormous tragedy, were challenged by the temptation to give over their lives to bitterness and anger, and they overcame it. I want to say something about the two men who lost their lives in a sincere effort to fellowship an unhappy man. Gary Darley was 20, from Simi Valley, California. His parents were David and the late Jill Darley. Gary had served less than half his mission when he died. He followed an older brother, Kelly Darley, who had also served in Texas. He was known to his teenage friends as a real straight shooter. He liked motorcycles, he had a girlfriend, and he surprised no one in the family when he accepted his mission call. His missionary journals, and both families provided me with their son's missionary journals, which really, I think, added a lot to being able to flesh them out. His missionary journals reflect a great joy in the companionship of other missionaries, the spiritual growth he felt he was undergoing, and a love of his family. Mark Fisher, 19, was from a very close, loving convert family in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. His parents were Kathy and Jim Fisher. He was considered a model young man and was completely devoted to his faith. One former bishop at a memorial service said he was the kind of young man you hoped and prayed someday your sons would be. He had been out on the mission field just 5 weeks. I think the night he was killed was probably the first night that he met Cleason. In an opening prayer at Elder Fisher's memorial service, a former bishop said something about the young man that I think is worth repeating as it applies to both of them. The prayer included, "May we remember, Father, that every man and woman gives his life for what he or she believes. Sometimes some give their lives for little or nothing because of little or nothing to believe in. We have but one life to live in this earth, and then it is gone. May we learn to live that we will believe in those things that are everlasting, that we will so live our lives that it will not be wasted. And may memory of this occasion serve to help us live our lives better in the realization that Elders Fisher and Darley had great faith and belief in what they lived for." Let me add one little set of concluding remarks, too. I was on the phone with the district attorney's office in Austin, Texas. I guess Friday I talked to them. Since all of this has opened up, they have reopened the case and are examining the possibility of re-prosecuting Cleason. Cleason's going to remain in prison in England until he has served his sentence. As I understand it, he has a 3-year sentence, and as I understand it, with credit for time served and possible gain time, he's likely to serve around 2 years, at which point he'll have no choice about being expelled from the country. And that gives the authorities in Texas some time to look at this. They are beginning to do some DNA examination. DNA was not available at the time of the original trial, looking at the possibility of retrying the case. Frankly, as a lawyer, I think there's some real problems with them re-prosecuting it. I'd be a little surprised if they can accomplish it, but I'm not upset if they make Cleason lose a lot of sleep over the next few years. I don't know how long it will take them to make the decision. They have to reassemble the evidence and try to determine what witnesses may still be around, and seek some results on this DNA testing that they're doing. With that, I'd be glad to answer any questions that anybody has or elaborate on other parts of the story if you're interested. Yes?
I've got a couple of questions. How did he acquire so many firearms? Was it through gun dealers or getting them from other dealers?
That's a mystery to me. And part of that mystery is this guy spent a lot of money. The only steady job I've ever seen him have is this 2 years working as a deputy sheriff. He's obviously a con man. I spent a week in Buffalo going through records and so on up there, and I found about $30,000 worth of bad debt judgments against him, which were entered in the early 70s. So that's $30,000 worth of money then. But I can't answer that question for you. I think a lot of the guns he had were guns that his parents owned. I gather there were a great many firearms in the house when he was growing up. Some of the guns that were seized in the big ATF raid are described as antiques, museum-quality antiques. He never got any of those returned to him, and I understand that some of them ended up in museums. They were good quality. I'm not a gun enthusiast at all. I have no idea what a Thompson machine gun costs, for instance. But I know that he had like 4 of them in the first raid, and he starts getting them in England. I don't know how you even get a Thompson submachine gun in England. But I'm unable to answer that question. And related to that, he's flying back and forth to Europe a lot. I'm assuming that doesn't come free either. I do know that some of the bad debt judgments against him involved a TWA credit card, but it is a mystery to me how he financed his activities. His parents were not wealthy people. He did not inherit money from them. and whatever proceeds they had, he quickly appropriated for himself and liquidated. His mother died a pauper in a publicly financed nursing home. He bled her of every dime she had and abused her. So I can't answer that.
Follow-up, what do you think set him off of guys in such a rage? Do you think it was a discussion that they weren't going to come back and see him anymore?
You mean the night the missionaries were killed? My theory is that that they told Darley, as the senior companion, probably told him, "We're not coming back anymore," and that it pushed a button and he shot them. Both missionaries' name tags were found in the grass outside of the taxidermy studio in an area where he kind of had an improvised shooting gallery. He used to demonstrate his shooting skills to people. I had a lot of people tell me that he apparently was a crack shot. He was a good marksman. And both of them have what appear to be .22 caliber bullet holes in them. If they're wearing them in the normal way, he may have sighted down on them. Part of the shooting gallery, he had a bunch of targets, you know, off from this like little bar he was at, and he would shoot at these targets and sometimes send people down to retrieve the target and bring him back to him so he could show what a good shot he was. I interviewed four or five people who had gone through this experience with him, and they went down and they said when they turned around and came back, they found him sighting down on them, which is kind of a creepy thing. And I suspect, I mean, that may well be what happened to the missionaries. And there was expert testimony in the trial that suggested that the bullet holes in the name tags appeared to be from a .22 caliber high-velocity bullet. They were incoming in that the writing on the name tag was the entrance side and the plug that burst out the back was the exit side. There was no blood on them. There was a pretty heavy rain in the area in the days leading up to the police getting out there to search, so it's likely that blood and trace evidence would have been washed away. But I'm thinking that they were shot under that circumstance. Yes?
Well, I work with schizophrenic people, and it always amazes me when they're prosecuted and if they're in control of their faculties. Not just you, but that.
Yeah. I do too, by the way. I routinely represent mentally ill people. That's kind of a specialty, so believe me, I'm sympathetic.
My question is there any possibility of, you know, if it's questionable to prosecute them again, is it possible that he could be committed to a case?
Well, I mean, I think you can certainly make an argument that he meets the criteria for involuntary hospitalization. I recently defended a really complicated death penalty case in Georgia where my client was schizoaffective disorder, which is a combination of schizophrenia and the manic depressive condition. And from what I've read about Cleason, there's a major depression as a feature of his illness a lot, and I've suspected that schizoaffective disorder may have applied to him. He's taking medication for depression at various times. You know, he's also 68 years old now and kind of slow moving. I think he's probably less dangerous than he was at one point, but he's certainly somebody who needs to be under extremely close supervision. My doubts about whether they could prosecute him at this point really have to do with kind of speedy trial due process considerations. I mean, the state could have re-prosecuted him on these murders at any point some years ago and chose not to, and I'm inclined to think that this may have as much to do with sort of politics and publicity as it does with the merits of a re-prosecution. And the families, to the best of my knowledge, have not been consulted about this decision at this point. And frankly, I'm not sure they would be eager about reopening all these old wounds at this point. They've all kind of come to their peace. By the way, one other thing I want to mention about the families that I find revealing. Subsequent to these murders, both families had several sons serve missions subsequent to this. And in one instance, with the great misgivings of the mother, who chose not to say anything. And, I mean, they seem to be really straight-up, faithful LDS families. I was really impressed with what I learned about them and when I met them. Any other questions? Yes? The question is, was there ever any indication of self-harm because of this depression? I haven't found any evidence. Well, the only evidence I found of that, this young man named Jack Paris, this young Mormon man who was fellowshipping him, he's the son of a stake patriarch there, related in the trial to an instance when Cleason said he hated the police, he would never surrender to the police, and that if the police ever came to his house, he would have to kill himself after killing as many police as he could. At another instance, Paris said Cleason took a gun out, put it to his head, and threatened to shoot himself. but it had the, it struck Paris as sort of theater, drama. That is the only incidence of suicidal gesture or ideation that I ever came across. And I kind of looked for that. I mean, I got some of his psychiatric records. The most recent of those psychiatric records is in the middle 1970s, so they're using a little different diagnostic terms, and they're usually people that have got him in custody for a short period of time. It's not a long observation, and it's not a situation where they really had much social history, you know, to work into that evaluation. Any other questions? Yes. In the death penalty, and frankly, I didn't know about his mental illness until I started getting into it. Although, when you think about the facts of this case, that kind of comes to mind. I mean, this is not something a normal person does. So I was thinking there was something amiss somehow. It was a death penalty case. I have a habit. I move fairly regularly in my profession. You know, you get run out of town as a defense lawyer from time to time. And whenever I go somewhere, I usually look for some aspect of Mormon history there that I can research. I really like, you know, digging out things and writing about stuff, particularly outside of Utah. And there is a place called the Austin History Center there that I went down and just went through their card catalogs and started looking under Mormon and things like that, seeing what I could find. And I found a file folder full of newspaper clippings about this, and that's when I thought, ah, I've got to look at this a little further. And the more I dug, the more I found, and the more I realized that this really was more than you could cover in an article, and that it should be a book. And it was the interest. I mean, it was really, it's a fascinating story in a macabre way. The other thing that struck me is I started talking to members. There are two stakes in Austin now, and I lived at one time or another in both of the stakes, and encountered a number of people who knew something about the story or had some contact with it. And they would frequently tell me these stories, like the story about him ending up in Lebanon, you know, and somehow involved with the PLO. I never could verify that these guys were PLO that he was involved with there, so I didn't say that in the book, but I kind of suspect they were. And I thought, that can't be true. This is just people who dislike this guy so much, they're sort of, you know, the story gets exaggerated. And I swear, everything I ran down, I was able to verify. It was just amazing. And when I went to Buffalo, I was a little surprised at how many records I could secure without having an authorization from him for release of those records. A lot of them had found their way into public records files. And because I have an emphasis on mental health and representing mentally handicapped clients, I'm particularly interested in what makes a guy like this. What process takes you from this little pink baby to someone who is capable of an act like that? And I'm very interested in trying to reconstruct the history and see what was there. And I found a lot on him, although I'm not sure I answered the questions to my own satisfaction. So, yes?
What have you found the impact to have been on that community there in Austin? I left there quite a few years later. When did you start researching?
I started in January 1995. That's okay. When I found the file in the Austin History Center.
Yeah,
the mission president was a man named Loveland from Idaho, and I did locate him, and he declined to talk to me. There are a number of documents attributed to him that are in that file up there. I never found an indication that Loveland made that call. I did find Bishop McCullough making that call. And well, yeah, I mean, and the one thing I also found is, you know, I'm talking to people 20, 25 years after the fact, and memories drift. That's just a function of human beings. And when I was writing the book, if I had a documentary source that it gave me one set of information and the later interview gave me something else, I generally wrote it up with a documentary source. I felt like that was the more reliable source. But I had a very tearful interview with Bishop McCullough in a restaurant. I remember it was the first time I met him. I tape recorded it, and we started talking about this. And he's, I believe he's stake president, or he's in the stake presidency now, one of the stakes out there, Convict Hill Stake, which is sort of an interesting name, or it's on Convict Hill Road, that's where the stake center is. And to this day, I believe Bishop McCullough feels personally responsible for the deaths of these young men, that he could have done something or should have done something more. I don't know what he could have done. I get that question from time to time. What can the church do to prevent tragedies like this? I don't think Bishop McCullough needs to feel that he is responsible for these deaths. I certainly don't think Gary Darley or Mark Fisher are responsible for their own deaths. They may not have exercised the best judgment in the world, but I don't know what information they had. To me, as many people as have gone out on missions for their church today, and in as many potentially dangerous environments as they go in, the miracle is that this hasn't happened more often. This is a complete aberration. This incident stands almost by itself. So, to me, that's one of the real stories of this. And I just don't, I'm not prepared to find anybody at fault for this other than Bob Cleason. I do think, one thing you find about Cleason, particularly in the church world, when we have investigators, it's part of Mormon culture. You know, we give them a lot of attention. And I think Cleason really liked that attention. He needed attention. And the other thing that happens is when you're 19, 20, 21, how do we survive past that age? I don't know. I mean, you don't have the judgment and experience in life to see that some people are maybe dangerous and that some of the stories you hear from some people are not believable. Now, the older members who had much exposure to people, to Cleason in these wards, fairly quickly saw him as a crackpot or worse. But it was the young missionaries and the young members who would sit, and when he said, I'm a CIA operative, and I cut the fingers off of Che Guevara, and I ran all this out. I mean, and these are stories he told. He said that he had the Congressional Medal of Honor that was awarded to him by presidents, that he hunted with LBJ. And this guy's living in a trailer in the back of a taxidermy studio by a garbage heap in rural Texas. Somebody who's been around a little bit isn't going to buy that, but these 19 and 20-year-old kids were believing it. And he could tell people, I got four PhDs and I speak nine languages. And the fact that he didn't speak anything but English to them or didn't give them a demonstration didn't seem to always persuade them that he wasn't believable. So, yes?
That takes me back to my reaction when you said he convinced this Swedish woman whom he married. He
At the time he did that, he was 38 years old. She was 18 or 19. She worked in the pornography business in Sweden. She was a clerk, apparently, in a store somewhere where he bought stuff. And he persuaded her to come to the States with him. The missionaries who were present at the wedding told me, one of them said, what was his phrase? She was something less than the ideal Mormon bride. Or he made some comment like that, that she was pretty hard-looking. That she may have been more interested in coming to the States. She ran from him once, and he retrieved her, went over to Europe, and talked her into coming back a second time. But I suspect she was not the sharpest blade in the box. And actually, this is another thing. This guy is married four times. And all four times, they are foreign nationals. And only one instance is English their native language. And I think that's another part of his sort of con man manipulative stuff. I think if you speak English, if you grow up in the United States, it's easier for you to understand when stories that people tell are not true because you understand the context of them. If you're from Sweden and I tell you I work for the CIA, you may not even really know what it is, and it may be easier for you to be conned on this sort of thing. But if you're from the United States and this guy living in a 10-foot trailer in the back of a taxidermy tells you he used to be head of the CIA for South America, you're going to go, right, I've been around a little bit. And so I don't think it was any accident that he married these foreign nationals who all appeared to be pretty gullible to me. They were all in the States, with the exception of the Swedish woman and the English lady. I say all, the first two, the Ecuadorian and the Mexican woman, were in the States. So, yes?
Has this case or any others that you've been involved with caused you to change your mind about the death penalty? Maybe favor
something? No. I mean, I'm opposed to the death penalty. I say this. I've had 12 or 13 of my clients have been executed, all but two in Texas. I do mourn the loss of some clients less than others. My opposition to the death penalty has a lot to do with its uneven application. It has more to do with geography and the race of the victim and factors like that, rather, and the quality of the lawyering, rather than the crimes of the offender. So, no, it doesn't change my opinion on that. And I'll be candid with you. The district attorney's office in Austin, Texas, had lost their file on this case. The district attorney who made the decision not to re-prosecute would never submit to an interview with me. I mean, I think he always saw me as a stalking horse for some political opponent he had, which is not true. I voted for him. But when I asked for the file, they had lost it. And when the case started hitting the news again and they wanted to reopen it, they wanted the page proofs of my book so that they could learn about the case again. So I gave them my page proofs and I gave them most of my research notes. And I told them I would cooperate and assist them in any way I could, but if they sought the death penalty, I would not assist in any way. They have pretty much assured me they will not seek death on a retrial. As a practical matter, this guy is going to outlive any appeal. Or, I mean, he would die before any appeal would be concluded anyway. There was another little anecdote I was going to tell you on that. Oh, also, when he popped up in England, they didn't have any information on him, so I spent about $1,000 in long-distance phone and fax and Federal Express stuff, sending the British authorities all of my copies of his prison records and conviction documents and things like that. So most of the case they got from my stuff. But no, it doesn't change my opinion. Yes? Bob Gleason.
Gary Gilmore?
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm planning on writing a book about the death penalty in general in the not-too-distant future. I just don't think I'm psychologically ready to write that yet. I'm not sure I want to spend a lot of time on true crime stuff. I'm really more interested in other aspects of Mormon writing, but I am very interested in Mormon responses to these kinds of things. I will say, of the 13 clients I've had executed, two have been Mormon, and I have one current LDS client still on the Florida death row. So Mormon, this happens to Mormons too. Yes?
If they lost the file, how can they prosecute the case?
Well, that's one of the reasons why I think there's a problem.
Maybe the file was deliberately lost at some point?
Well, no, I mean, you were
way back then.
Yeah. We're not talking about something that happened 25 months ago. We're talking 20, 25 years ago. I don't see anything sinister in the file disappearing in that period of time. When I realized I was going to be doing a book, I was interested in photographs. So I went to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals is the court that handled the appeal. And it's about a 3,000-page record, and they have photographs and a number of other pieces of evidence that were entered into it. And I was looking for some piece of it, like the missionary's name tags. I wanted to get a photograph of that to include in the book. Well, it was gone. And the Fishers later on told me that somebody whom they don't know mailed them their son's name tag with a bullet hole in it a couple of years after the case was over, along with some other material that was entered into evidence. And I thought, what idiot did that? I mean, it almost precludes the chance to retry the case. Now, the other thing is, in a trial, when you submit evidence into the record, in Texas, the court reporter is the custodian of those materials, not the clerk of the court. So it may end up in some court reporter's garage somewhere. I was, subject to sun and other kinds of decontamination. I'm a little surprised that the district attorney's office told me they located the court reporter and located much of the evidence. Now, they haven't itemized to me what it was, but I think the critical evidence is going to be the watches with the blood flecks on it. Both missionaries had watches that were fairly distinct. Cleason had in a box in his mobile home a box with about a dozen watches in it. Now, some people think he's a serial killer and that those were his trophies. I'm not inclined to believe that. I know there are other people who have looked at him who do believe that sincerely. But the watches had just enough blood on it that they could test it with the test they had then and identified as blood, but they couldn't type it. And it wasn't enough to do DNA on, so they couldn't attach the blood to the victims. Another piece of important evidence, I think, is the clothes that he had outside. It was one of these jumpsuit things, and there were smears of blood on the clothes and head hair. Now, head hair is a kind of forensic evidence that they think that, I'm not sure I buy this as a defense lawyer, but I know there are people who think they can. You can look at it under a microscope and get not a positive identification, but a very high probability identification associating the head hair with the head of the victims, or whoever you're trying to match it with. Well, both of these missionaries had pretty long hair when they got their mission calls. Both of them had family members cut their long hair into the standard missionary haircut. Both of them had girlfriends who collected the hair, put them in baggies, and kept them in memento drawers somewhere. And so when they found hair on the bandsaw and on Cleason's clothes, they immediately had these samples to match it up with, and they said a positive match on the hair. That's the closest thing that came to positive evidence of the match. There was a good bit of blood and human tissue on the bandsaw. The testimony of the experts was that this had all come from someone who was already dead. Or I say there was a good bit of blood. There was minimal blood. But there wasn't enough to get a blood type on, there might have been enough for DNA. Now, I never saw this stuff. When I started investigating this, I thought about trying to locate that material and maybe have DNA testing done, but I couldn't locate it, and the DA says they've now located it. Well, I think if it was a matter of putting him on the streets, you know, go and sin no more, they would have re-prosecuted. But they knew they had him on these other charges, and they were slam dunk cases. I mean, they didn't have much trouble getting convictions on the other cases. And he got pretty heavy sentences for the other cases, you know, as sentences go for those crimes. So, yes? Well, there are two theories on the bodies. Let me go to that one first. There was a manuscript found in his trailer called A Thousand White-Tailed Deer. It was about a poacher's life. And it was signed by John T. Williamson, one of his aliases. And in that, he describes how to dispose of the bodies of poached animals. He suggests that you get a burlap bag, you take the unused animal parts, you weight the bag with bricks, and you drop it in a river somewhere where you like to fish, that would attract fish and turn it into a good fishing hole. The prosecution entered that manuscript into evidence and let the jury speculate on whether that was what he did with the bodies. The other thing is, taxidermy studios frequently have arrangements with a rendering business where they take this unused animal matter and it's converted into fertilizer or chicken feed or something like that. They leave these materials in 50-gallon drums and they're picked up a couple of times a week. This particular studio or taxidermy studio was by a rendering company there. It's quite possible that they ended up in that and ended up in a rendering plant. Pardon?
Yeah.
Well, that's true. To be honest with you, I had not thought about that until you mentioned that. Now, as to him being a split personality, I'm not sure I even believe in split personalities myself. I don't think there's any question Cleason's mentally ill, but he's obviously very high-functioning. I doubt that he was innocent by reason of insanity. He clearly understood what he did was wrong. He clearly made efforts to conceal and cover up, and he always denied having to do this. I just don't buy that he's a split personality. I think he was adept at coming up with aliases. So, did you have a question? Yes. The three clients I have, it was never mentioned. I was unaware that they were Mormon until in the course of my conferring with them this information came out. Two were converts to the church. They're the kind of people, you know, they hang around for a month after they're baptized and they wander off. And then one was raised in an LDS home. He has since been executed. I will say in the publicity about this case, there was no sliding or slamming of the church at all. It was all positive publicity. There was a lot said about what wonderful, worthy young guys these were. There was no downside for the church at all in it.
So, I just wondered if that would be
a possession. Yeah. One other thing I want to mention before we leave, too. I just started a website. I forgot to put this out. If anybody is interested, that's my website. It's www.kendriggs, KENDRIGGS.com. And the reason I mentioned that, I'm not computer literate. I had to pay somebody to do this for me, and we're still slowly getting it up. It's got some bugs in it. But by the end of this week, I'm going to post the paper that I've given you here on the website. There's some information about the book, and I have a Mormon history section in there where I'm slowly posting some of my other writing and research. There's also some death penalty stuff there, but I suspect people are mostly interested in the Mormon stuff. And I have a few business cards up here on the table that has the website on it if anybody wants to take one of those. Other than that, I guess we're out of time. I'll stick around if anybody has any further questions. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.